Good afternoon. In the next few minutes, I'll be talking about Ralph Kiner and Branch Rickey, and as the subtitle says, Not a Happy Marriage. And we have, obviously, the Mahatma on your right, and here we have Ralph Kiner, and here he's escorting Elizabeth Taylor to the world premiere of 12 O'Clock High in Los Angeles. I'll talk a little bit about that in a couple of minutes. Okay, I'll start with the Pittsburgh Pirates in the late 1940s. And we'll talk first about them being purchased by John Galbraith and Tom Johnson, who were the principal owners. And then there were some minority owners, including Bing Crosby. So they purchased the Pirates in 1946. In 1947, they acquire Hank Greenberg. And so Greenberg joins the Pirates in 47. Kiner had come up in 1946 and led the league in home runs in 1946. Now, the Pirates during this period are a second division team, except for 1948, where they do manage to finish fourth. With the acquisition of Greenberg, the Pirates build Greenberg Gardens in 1947. What is Greenberg Gardens? Well, they moved the left field fence in, I believe, from 365 to 335 in the Power Alley, and that becomes Greenberg Gardens. Obviously, Greenberg leaves in 48, so it then becomes Kiner's Corner. One thing that's obvious in the late 1940s is the Pirate fans dig the long ball as the attendance each year, except for 1946. Each year after 1946 up to 1950, the Pirates draw over 1 million. And in 1948, they draw 1.5 million, over 1.5 million. Now, Ralph Kiner, before Mr. Rickey, as I said, Kiner joined the Pirates in 1946 and led the league in home runs in 1946. And then with Greenberg Gardens, Kiner hit 51 home runs in 1947. He joined the 50 home run club, but he tied Johnny Mize in home runs. Both of them, obviously, Kiner had Kiner's Corner, and Mize had that short porch in right field in the Polo Grounds. He also tied Mize in home runs in 1948. Both of them hit 40 home runs in 1948. Kiner was an all-star in 1948, 49, and 50, but not the most adept outfielder. And he does become a bit of a celebrity. As you saw in that first slide, he's escorting Elizabeth Taylor to 12 O'Clock High. Actually, Bing Crosby set that up for him. Although he did pursue Elizabeth Taylor later, he was a little too late because she apparently had married Nicky Hilton by that time. By the time he came in off a road trip. Kiner also dated Ava Gardner and Janet Leigh. And he met Janet Leigh when they had that filming that great movie, Angels in the Outfield, here in Pittsburgh. Rickey allowed the Pirate organization actually to participate in that. Pirate players actually participated in the movie. Kiner meets Janet Leigh, who stars in the movie with Paul Douglas, and dates her. So it kind of becomes kind of a celebrity, a lot of endorsements, a lot of appearances, and that leads to some of the issues with Mr. Rickey. Mr. Rickey comes to Pittsburgh. In October 3rd, 1950, Rickey signs a contract with the Pirates to be vice president and general manager for 5 years, with the provision that he'd be an advisor for an additional 5 years. Of course, Rickey had lost a bit of a power struggle in Brooklyn due to Walter O'Malley, and so was pursuing this opportunity with the Pirates. Now, interesting, this appears to be something that Galbraith pursued as a principal owner, even without the knowledge of his co-owner or principal owner, Tom Johnson, and that leads to some issues later on. There's no doubt that there's a lot of enthusiasm and optimism for Rickey coming to Pittsburgh. The Pirate fans think that this may indeed bring a world championship in the near future. Rickey is a little bit cautious, pointing out that it does take to build a farm system a few years, Players take 3 to 4 years to make the major leagues once they're signed. But he's also very positive and very optimistic about the future of the Pirates farm system. Now, there's one issue that the Pirate writers and the Pirate fans are a bit concerned about. I think we all are aware that Ricky was a big proponent of the five-tool player. Players not only had to hit, but they had to field, they had to throw, and they had to run. Well, kind of doesn't necessarily have all of those five tools. So what about kind of, asked the Pittsburgh writers, are you going to keep him? And Ricky replies soon after he signs with the Pirates, we don't have enough kindness on the Pittsburgh club, so why would I trade the one I have? However, there are some storm clouds. Billy Meyer, who's the manager of the Pirates, kind of says, you know, next year we may move kind of out of left field and try him at first place, first base. And he does play 58 games at first base in 1951. He once again leads the National League in home runs with 42. The Pirates finished seventh with a record of 64 wins and 90 losses. And for the first year, about 3 or 4 years, they fall below a million in attendance. I don't think that can be attributed. It was only 20,000 below. It was 980,000. That can't be necessarily attributed to Ricky's coming on board because, obviously, television. And I'm not sure exactly what KDKA was doing with televising Pirate games back then, but I'm sure television had some impact on attendance, just as it did throughout the rest of the major leagues. During 1951, Ricky realizes the picture here in Pittsburgh isn't as rosy as he thought. They're having some financial difficulty, and he initiates some cost-cutting moves, but also states that he's going to not necessarily slash player salaries. Now, the 1951-52 offseason. This is when it gets really interesting between Ricky and Kina. Before Ricky coming to Pittsburgh, Kina negotiated salaries directly with the owner, and that was Mr. Galbraith, although Roy Hamey was the general manager. But he negotiated directly with Galbraith. And Galbraith and Kina had a bit of a relationship. Kina could charm Galbraith. At least that's what Hamey said. So he goes directly to negotiate his 52 contract with Galbraith. He's able to negotiate a 38% increase in his salary from, I believe it was $67,000, $68,000 to $90,000. This makes him, if not the highest paid baseball player, one of the highest paid baseball players in the major leagues. The players see very little or no raise, but kind of gets this $90,000 contract. Now, as you can imagine, Ricky is a little bit perturbed when he realizes that Galbraith and Kina come up with this deal for $90,000. And after realizing Kina's contract, he authors his 15-page infamous memo, personal and confidential, to Galbraith. Now, his intent in this memo is really to deprecate Kina both off the field and on the field, hopefully. Then Galbraith would realize he needs to trade Kina. Now, what does he say in this 15-page memo? Well, Kina has too many outside commercial interests. That really rankles Ricky. His love for the game of golf. By the way, as I touched on Kina being a celebrity, he settles in Palm Springs, California. And when he's not playing baseball, he's playing golf with a lot of movie stars out in the Palm Springs area. So that's bothering Ricky. Now, here's an interesting one. In that memo, he basically criticizes Kina for sharing an apartment with another person who is known for promiscuous domestic infidelity. Now, if anybody asks me who that other person is, I don't know. And it really doesn't say in any literature. But apparently, Ricky knew who that person was. His role as a player representative, this is kind of the emergence of the player movement, and Ricky isn't necessarily happy with Kina's role in that movement. And then requesting special privileges beyond what should be expected. Hamey alludes to some of that when he was the general manager, or as the general manager, saying kind of had special traveling privileges and hotel privileges as the star of the Pittsburgh team. And finally, he gets to something that relates to his on-field presence. He criticizes his speed and arm strength. And interesting enough, Ricky composes a bit of a ditty, and he includes this in his memo to Galbraith. And I love this ditty. Babe Ruth could run, our man cannot. Babe Ruth could throw, our man cannot. Babe Ruth can steal a base, our man cannot. Babe Ruth is a good fielder, our man is not. Babe Ruth could hit with power to all fields, our man cannot. Ruth never requested a diminutive field to fit him, our man does. And of course, he's alluding to Kindest Corner and that short left field porch. Interesting enough, Yankee Stadium, the house that Ruth built. Ricky doesn't seem to realize that Ruth has that short right field porch in Yankee Stadium to hit at. Of course, he didn't necessarily stipulate that in his contract. Obviously, Ricky is not happy with Kinda. The 1952 season, a terrible year for the Pirates, as they finished the season with 42 wins and 112 losses, finishing last place, and attendance plummets to 686,673 fans. But it's not last in the National League, which kind of shows you that the dynamic that's working. There is the advent of television, and baseball is suffering throughout, not only in Pittsburgh. And now we get to the 1952-1953 season. This is, again, an interesting period between Ricky and Kind. Now, the result of the memo that Ricky sent to Galbraith is, Galbraith says, okay, from now on, you're going to negotiate with Kind. I'm staying out of it. So the Rickies, and I say that the Rickies because Branch Rickey Jr. gets involved in these negotiations, the Rickies undertake their negotiations with Kind. Now, this is when Ricky kind of makes his famous statement. We finished in last place with you. We can finish in last place without you, which is his legendary comment as they enter this negotiating period about Ralph Kind. Branch Rickey Jr. goes to Palm Springs and supposedly floats the idea of a 25% cut in salary for Kind. Well, as you can imagine, that goes nowhere. So next Branch Rickey Sr. gets involved. And this, according to a lot of sources, there's a lot of information that is conflicting to some extent. I hope I got this right. I think I've got this right because I've gone through quite a bit of sources to follow these negotiations. On February 13th, and that's a little bit of an error there, it should be 53 instead of 52, Kind of supposedly offered $76,500 by Ricky in a meeting with Ricky. And Ricky supposedly grants him the ability to show up for spring training on March 15th. That causes a real issue. Where are the Pirates spending spring training in 1953? Cuba. They've negotiated with Cuba for the Pirates to be down there for spring training. When the Cuban officials find out that the one star of the Pittsburgh Pirates isn't going to show up until maybe half spring training is half over, they go, no way, and protest to Ricky. Ricky goes back to Kind and says, how about if you show up on March 1st? And Ricky and kind of points out, hey, I still haven't signed the contract yet. And you know, March 1st is a little bit difficult. I have this shop out in Palm Springs, and that beginning of March is our busy season. So I really don't think I'm going to be showing up on March 1st. Well, you can imagine what Ricky's reaction must have been when he heard that from Kinda. The other interesting thing about this whole issue of Cuba that caused a little bit of concern between Ricky and Kinda is the games that are going to be played in Cuba almost all at night. And the Pirate players say, hey, this isn't our idea of spring training. Play like 32 games and 28 of them being night games. So we're not happy. And who do they complain to? Well, their player rep. And their player rep is Ralph Kiner. So Kiner goes to Major League Baseball and protests that. It really didn't go anywhere, but surely perturbed Ricky. Kiner finally agreed to a salary, which really was the same as that February 13th salary, $76,500. After receiving an ultimatum from Ricky that he had to show up by March, sign a contract and show up by March 15th. So Kiner signs his contract and tries to make the best of it, saying he looks forward to spending a great year in Pittsburgh. But obviously now you can see how this tension between Ricky and Kiner has heightened. Well, there's no doubt that Ricky is trying to peddle Kiner, but really doesn't seem to have much success. But in early June, the Cubs come to Pittsburgh, and Whit Matthews is the general manager of the Cubs, and he apparently corrals Ricky and says, hey, you know, I need to talk to you about something. Well, the upshot was the next day they announced a multiplayer trade between the Cubs and the Pirates, 1 hour before the start of the game. So kind of goes to the Cubs, has to run into, the opposing clubhouse now, take off his Pirate uniform, put on the visiting Cub uniform, and go out and play against the Pirates that day. And the Pirates won that game, 6-1. As you can imagine, trading kind of the one star they did have caused a lot of angst in Pittsburgh. Writers weren't happy, fans weren't happy. And not only were the writers and fans not happy, but some of Ricky's fellow owners of the Pirates weren't happy. Remember Tom Johnson? He really didn't sign on to bringing Ricky out to Pittsburgh in the first place, and now he's upset. And so there's a lot of issues between the Pittsburgh folks and Mr. Ricky. Ricky is still optimistic, pointing out that his plan is working. His five-year plan is working. But in August of 1954, Ricky announces he will not return after his five-year contract. In 1955, Ricky still holds out hope that possibly Galbraith will hire him for an additional year as general manager. But Galbraith realizes that he's between Ricky and Tom Johnson and sticks with Tom Johnson. Ricky's not going to have a contract after 55, although he still is that advisor for the next 5 years. Okay, I don't know how much Kiner knew as, for instance, that personal and confidential memo could really not find any information as to whether Kiner knew that. Obviously he knows it now because it's in the Library of Congress, or obviously Kiner is not with us right now, but that was a Kinerism, by the way. but I don't know when he found, when he became aware. But years later, he is quoted as saying as the following about Ricky. He was impossible. He was a hypocrite. He would use any means to sign a ball player for as little as he could get him. He was a mastermind, a brilliant man, but certainly no friend to the player. What's Kiner's legacy? Well, he was just elected to the Hall of Fame in 1975. This was his last year of eligibility. He gets in by just one vote. And there are some individuals who question whether or not Kiner belongs. I personally think he does indeed belong. Given his contributions later on with the Mets and also here in Pittsburgh, he's an individual that belongs in the Hall of Fame. Seven consecutive seasons leading National League home runs. I think that actually is a record for the number of consecutive seasons leading a league in home runs. I checked with Bonds and I checked with Ruth, and neither one of them did that. So I think that's a record. Although I'm originally, you can take the Jersey City accent, so I'm originally from the New York area, and when I was presented this to a couple of my cousins in New York, they said, well, you know, I didn't realize Kiner even was with Pittsburgh. But we remember him for those 51 years with the New York Mets, and of course his many, many kinderisms, if Casey Stengel were alive today, he'd be spinning in his grave. Kinder, as years went on, became, and he remember he was the player representative, became kind of a figure who talked a lot about the relationship between players and the owners. And in 1991 was invited to speak to New York Bar Association, and actually this speech of his is actually online. And he speaks about collective bargaining, arbitration, and his difficult time negotiating with Ricky. Ricky's legacy with the Pirates. Well, if you look at what happened on the field from 1950 to 1950, it wasn't very, very good. They finished in the second division and last four times. The attendance dropped significantly during Ricky's tenure. But let's give Ricky his due. During that period, and we'll hear more about this, I believe, on Saturday, Ricky signs or acquires Dick Groat, and we've heard about Clemente, but it was kind of a brilliant move by Ricky to get Clemente. Elroy Face was a Rule 5 acquisition, and he also signs Bill Mazeroski. And without those individuals, I don't think the 1960 championship is possible. In fact, once Ricky left in 55, there's a gradual improvement for the rest of the decade, culminating in the World Championship of 1960. And he signed Curtis Roberts, the first African-American to play for the Pirates. Interesting enough, though, that didn't occur until 1954. So given Ricky's groundbreaking in Robinson in 46, it took him 3 years to get an African-American on the field in Pittsburgh, although he did have some in the minor leagues. Now, let's get back to the situation with Kinder. As Bill James is quoted, Ricky, in one of the oddest moves of his career, to begin systematically destroying Kinder's reputation as a player, and I'll add, as an individual also, so that he could trade him, it's nuts. And I think what James is alluding to is you're trying to get rid of a ball player. You're trying to trade a ball player. You don't make it obvious that you don't like the guy either on the field or off the field. You try to boost him up in order to trade him. Ricky's treatment of Kinder was not his finest hour. Thank you. And then the sources for this, I got the most... Branch, I really would recommend those of you interested in this, Andrew O'Toole's book, Branch Ricky in Pittsburgh. And then we have the two biographies, Ricky by Murray Polner and by Lee Loewenfisch. And Loewenfisch will be chairing the panel that will be discussing Ricky in Pittsburgh. And that will have Dick Groat and others on that panel. And then some of the files on Ricky in the Baseball Hall of Fame and also Kinder. So thank you very much. Question?
Yes. First, very quickly, where can we read the 15-page menu memo?
Oh, actually, it's in O'Toole's book.
Okay, thanks.
He has that as an appendix in his book.
Okay.
It's
now,
in the Library of Congress, so you could probably also dig through the internet.
No, the book's fine. Okay, but here's my real question. I distinctly remember Kinder in an interview with Donald Honig giving a much simpler explanation for all this, which actually makes a lot of sense. And I swear he said, I knew I was through in Pittsburgh the minute they hired Ricky because Ricky never wanted to keep anybody around who was over 30, which he practically was. And in fact, Ricky's estimate that Kiner's best years were behind him when he traded him turned out to be spot on.
He was right. He was right on.
Yeah.
He was right on in trading Kiner.
But you didn't... But Ricky never brought that up in the memo or otherwise, that this guy, by the time we're any good, this guy is going to be too old to help?
I didn't see that actually referred to. But obviously, let's face it, Ricky is quoted as saying, I'd rather trade a guy 1 year too early than 1 year too late.
Yes.
So when Ricky does come to Pittsburgh and when the scribes ask him, what are you going to do with Kinder, I'm sure that's on their mind, the fact that Ricky is noted for trading people in their prime for two reasons. First, it's downhill after their prime, and secondly, that's when you can get the most for them.
Right.
So they had it on their mind that he was going to possibly trade Kiner.
Yep. Okay, thanks.
Hi, John. Lee Lone.
Yeah, Lee, how are you?
A couple of things. In the article that I read before in the Steel City National Pastime, you mentioned that that Ricky unloaded Roe, Preacher Roe, and Billy Cox. It's really the other way around. And the relationship between Galbraith and Ricky was one of the more bizarre. It's understandable, but it was bizarre because he kept, in his years in Brooklyn, Ricky kept unloading people on Galbraith.
Right.
And so Galbraith, Preacher Roe, who he had signed in St. Louis, hadn't done much in Pittsburgh because it wasn't a good team, and Billy Cox wasn't playing much. They were became keys to the Boys of Summer. And Galbraith thought so much of Ricky's trading ability, that's one of the reasons he brought him to Pittsburgh. The other thing, Tom Johnson, and you mention it today, that's so crucial. Tom Johnson never wanted Ricky, and by the time Ricky's years developed in Pittsburgh, he was anything that Ricky wanted, he would oppose. And he warned Galbraith, Ricky, that he was expensive.
Yeah.
And Galbraith wanted him so much that he did take him. Now, I've heard from Ricky's grandson that Branch wanted to sign Banks and he wanted to sign Koufax. But and Banks was certainly in this period you're talking about. But by then, they didn't want to do any other money. So
I think I also read that really the finances were such that they couldn't really get some of those ball players.
Again, I agree it wasn't his finest hour, but it also there were a lot of extenuating
right.
circumstances.
Let me ask you a quick question, since you are an expert on Ricky. Did Ricky know about Pittsburgh as the days in Brooklyn were fading?
Oh, well, he knew when John L. Smith died. The third and the really rich man in the Dodger ownership. When Smith died in 1950 during the All-Star break, he knew he was gone. And that's when Galbraith came in and said, listen, I know you don't want to leave Brooklyn, but you got an opportunity to start here at the bottom. And he finds Zeckendorf to bid for Ricky's share of the Dodgers, and as Andy McHugh, my friend and O'Malley biographer, points out, O'Malley's mistake was he offered Ricky only what Ricky paid in 1945 for the team, $333,000. Zeckendorf comes in and offers $1 million, and O'Malley has to top that bid, and then when he finds out that the capital fee that was put in that contract, the $50,000 went into Ricky's pocket. That's that's when he knew that that had been sort of a hoax. So,
Thank you.
Yeah.
No, yeah.